I think your turnout on a rainy day suggests that many of you look on the subject and on the speaker as important as do the council members and staff of the Miller Center. We talk from time to time, as President Shannon could tell you, about areas that might be explored by the Miller Center, and 2.5 years ago we began talking about the area of education. It seemed to us that this was an area which at any given day one would see the importance of the subject both at the national and the state level, and that it continued to impinge upon executive branch leadership, although it was a state problem. Moreover, it is a problem which even those of us who outside of Boston, New York, Washington are sometimes considered in the hinterland seems to be a matter of first importance to an area, for instance, like Richmond. I found it of interest that yesterday on the front page of the Richmond Times-Dispatch there was an article about the Bell Report, which had just come out, whereas that distinguished newspaper, the New York Times, saw fit, for the moment at least, to put the Bell Report on page 20. The Times made up for it by giving front page coverage to its discussion of this issue of the liberal arts, which reviving around the nation, which is a matter of some importance. But wherever one turns, a whole section on Sunday's Times on education life, the whole subject of education is central to our concern. And President Shannon and his colleagues on the Council of the Miller Center gave us the green light some months ago to have a series of forums on the presidency in education. No one would that I know is more important and more appropriate to launch a discussion on that subject than is Frank Keppel. The name Keppel, for those of us who have worked in education and philanthropy, is legendary. In fact, if the truth would be known, why most of the one-liners that some of us engage in, such as that in philanthropy, like baseball, you score runs only when you bunch hits, go back to his father's commentary on the subject. But in his own right, Frank Keppel has been a major figure in the field of education. Some of the more interesting activities are not even mentioned in the usual biographical references to what he did. For instance, he was instrumental in a little specialized unit that planned and launched the establishment of the GI Bill of Rights after World War II. And he was a member of the famous Ashby Commission, which in a sense set the tone for the future of education and higher education in Nigeria. Many of you know from the announcements you've received that he was U.S. Commissioner of Education from 1962 to 65. He was Assistant Secretary of Education in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare from 65 to 66. He was born in New York, educated at Harvard, has served as assistant to the provost of Harvard, been a member of the Board of Overseers of Harvard, and was Dean of the Faculty of Education from 1948 to 1962, and returned as senior lecturer at Harvard in 77. Been chairman of the Board of General Learning Corporation from 66 to 74, chairman of the National Student Aid Coalition from 1980 to the present, author of the book The Necessary Revolution in Education, trustee of a number of bodies, including the Carnegie Corporation, vice chairman of the Lincoln Center for Performing Arts, and member of the National Commissions on Library and Information Services. one could go on and on in terms of his accomplishments, but the aspect that makes him, to me, the appropriate person to begin our inquiry and dialogue into this subject is there was no one for those of us in the field of philanthropy with whom one could both talk ideas in New York get down to the grubby business of dealing with a mendicant, which he was from time to time. So often, only the latter is a matter of interest to those who approach foundations. But those of you who've known Frank Keppel know that whether young people or old people were the responsible figures at the foundation giving end, one of the most stimulating and challenging people with whom they had to deal over the years with Frank Keppel. So I'm delighted that he is our first speaker.
Yeah, thank you, Ken, very much. It's a big pleasure to be here with some old friends. The old friends part of it makes me nervous. I know some of them. One Hunter will say, God knows. He was the coxswain for my brother's Cambridge crew, which lost to Oxford. So let me get ahead of Hunter. That's true, Tom.
That's deadly true. Twice for me. Once for me.
Yeah, once. That's right. I forgot you were trying. It's obvious that well, I'm very grateful to Jen and to Ken for getting me here. It's obvious that Ken established me in the Eastern establishment in a hell of a hurry, you know, the kind of fellow who was brought up on the New York Times. It's true, I can't deny it. But it's only fair to say that my father's one-liners did not always come out to the complete benefit of his five sons. He once pointed out that he had not made the Carnegie Corporation money. Andrew Carnegie had made it. Andrew Carnegie was the philanthropist. My father gave it away. So he clearly couldn't be called a philanthropist. Therefore, he said, a new word had to be invented. He was, he said, a philanthropoid, a new animal. Now, have you given thought to going through life with your arms below your knees as the son of a philanthropoid? it's not pure benefit, you understand. Ken, clearly knowing me, did not, because I'm an academic handyman, it was another one of my father's phrases, he said that being an academic handyman, not a scholar with no pretense to it, is, my father said, an honorable occupation. Please note the careful use of adjective and noun. It's an honorable occupation, and it's in that category that I'm talking to you, I hope, today. Though it's been pointed out that a fellow who started his life, as I did as a sculptor, and failed, when he went to Washington, he became a chiseler, which may or may not. That may or may not be an honorable occupation. Though I trust in the Miller Center, it will be so regarded. But clearly, I'm not asked as a scholar or an historian or even as a history buff. But I'm afraid that what you're going to get in my introductory remarks is going to be the result of an amateur historian or a history buff. I hope that later on in the discussion, if you have any questions about my personal experience with presidents, for which, by the way, I've carefully prepared my off-the-cuff remarks, I'd be glad to demonstrate that expertise, but that's not what I'm going to do here. The truth of the matter is I didn't have enough experience with presidents to justify any kind of a lecture. Couldn't fill up the topic very well. Or certainly not with ladies present in the light of Mr. Johnson. However, that's a totally different issue. But there is perhaps some kind of a justification for a history buff in the role I'm in today. I think it's true, isn't it, that the amateur tends to reveal his values by what he chooses to emphasize in recounting history. I think we all do it to a degree, how we put history together. The amateur does. That'll show up in what he chooses to quote, I think. This is likely, I hope, to be the case when in effect you're asking yourselves to assess an educator as he assesses the president assessing education. That's what you're asking. You're going to have to assess me as I'm assessing the president as he assesses education. Therefore, the quotes that I'm going to use, you'll have to realize, are taken from something. And what I took is the key issue. And maybe there's an argument here, Ken, further center. These errors that I make will encourage somebody to go find out what is the truth. What was left out of the quote? What was left out of what went before and left after? If so, that's what I'm going to throw you. And I hope you get an idea of what the questions are and whom to trust and so forth. What I intend to do is to quote little snippets from inaugural addresses by presidents of the United States or their annual messages to the Congress. Just those two will be the sources, the inaugural addresses or the annual statements to the Congress. I'm a little afraid that Professor Dante Germino is here. He put out a book on this topic, and he, of his own memory, will know what I've omitted. But if he's not here, I'm a little relieved. However, you can ask him afterward. So let me go ahead. On the topic of the presidency and education. My justification, by the way, for doing this is it's all Ken's fault. He wrote me the following letter. Quote, "We find that the role of the president in promoting educational change and providing national leadership for American educational institutions has been given insufficient attention in the presidential literature. One former commissioner of education with whom the center has been in communication has written," I didn't write this, somebody else must have. There are lots of commissioners of education, you can count them in the dozens. "Biographers of individual presidents have not dug into this subject in any depth. Students of the presidency as an institution tend to ignore it," end quote, from Ken. And it's on that basis that I'm going to proceed in suggesting some lines of inquiry. The things I'm going to quote are from Mr. Washington through Mr. Johnson. And for periods later than that, may I depend on your memory, because I have not attempted to take it out from there. Also, they wrote too much. It seems reasonable to assume, in the first place, that these documents, that is, the presidential inaugural addresses and annual messages, are important both for what they say and for what they don't say. The topics to which the president gave treatment in these documents are likely to be the ones they thought to be very important at that particular time. And therefore, they left a lot of other things out that they thought weren't that important at that particular time. Some of you have dealt with this, you remember this. Remember how hard it was to get even half a sentence into some presidential inaugural address or annual message. We used to struggle with it, and I struggled with it in the easy days. Well, Kennedy and Johnson, we loved that stuff. But it must have been a lot tougher before. The first thing to say, by the way, about these presidential inaugural addresses and annual messages is that there isn't much about education. That's the first thing to say. There isn't that much about education as you look back over the history of it. This little book that I've got in my hand has, you see that thing? It's one of those civilized little books that non-scholars can use. And you see how they're pretty short pages? Now you think that all of that statement, you're wrong. Less than half of it are quotes on education from the presidents, Washington through Johnson. Snippets, the fellow who edited it got snippets, but you'll notice it isn't much. It's a lot of white space, and even what they've got is more rhetoric than proposals. So the first question to ask is, why so little, relatively speaking? Just imagine if you had foreign policy. Just imagine if you had economic issues. Just imagine if you had racial issues or anything else. Now, I think we all know, you better than I probably, from other papers of presidents, that it probably wasn't any lack of interest on the part of the presidents. when you consider their own lives and what they did. For example, you'll remember that General Washington, President Washington, was quoted, but very briefly, in his messages, himself felt strongly about the issue. Perhaps particularly strongly, and I suspect that if you really want to know where somebody, a man, thinks something is important, you go to his will. And Washington left $50,000 to see a plan devised on a liberal scale which have a tendency, please note the purpose, a tendency to spread systematic ideas through all parts of this rising empire, thereby to do away local attachments and state prejudices. And he left it in his will to set up a university. He tried while president to get the Congress to agree to a university, a national university to which young men would come. They were men, I guess. Young men could come and learn together and tend to form or help to create a nation. He left that in his will. By the way, when I was commissioner, I tried to find that money.
Went to Washington and lived.
I don't know where the hell it went. Did it go to Washington? All I know was that Doug Dillon, Secretary of Treasury, said he didn't have it. That's okay.
Liberty Hall Academy.
Is that right?
Named at Washington College.
Is that where that money went to? No wonder I couldn't find it. But one of the fellows on the staff, I said, ought to do some compound interest for me, would you? It would have been a great success if we could have done it. But that was where President Washington put it, despite his efforts. He felt very strongly, but I'm not quoting. You understand the message. He put a message up. But he didn't do that much, put in his will. The issue of education was very strong interest of Mr. Jefferson's. This is a crazy place to have to say it. I don't have to say it. But by and large, the quotations, and the educators love to quote Mr. Jefferson, the quotations are not from his inaugural messages or from his annual messages. And in his case, a second theme is at issue here, I think. Mr. Jefferson, of course, you know better than I, felt very strongly that the Constitution was a document which meant what it said. And if he was going to propose things, which, by the way, he did in education, and I'll quote come in a minute, that was going to have to come as a result of a constitutional amendment permitting the federal government to get into educational matters. And he tried it once or twice, but there isn't much about educational matters in his presidential papers, or less than you'd expect, because of that block. Which raises another central issue of what I'm talking about. The reason for so little, then, relatively speaking, in a third of this little book, may have been because education was regarded fundamentally and acted on as a matter for the states from the very beginning. The issue, in part, for the presidents was enshrined in constitutional silence, if I may put it that way. It's certainly true that many presidents, Mr. Jefferson among them, believed that the constitutional amendment would be needed, but without it, why talk? In effect, Ken Thompson maybe should have asked me not to read the inaugural or annual messages of the president, but of the governors. But he didn't, thank God. In any case, that wasn't the topic he asked me to speak to. And as usual, Ken may have been right to ask me to speak to the president's topic. Because I'm going to ask you to make a little shift in your mind about the meaning of the word. If you take a broader definition of what the word education means, one that is not restricted to a school or a college or that kind of an institution, but rather one, the best example I know is from the meaning of paideia in the Greek sense that Werner Jaeger used in that remarkable book of his, that education is the effect and the impact of the entire society on the person growing up and living, the whole of the society, not the institution. Then I think presidential statements about education may make a little more sense. On this matter, I think it's fair to say that the early presidents really did have a good deal to say. Clearly, Mr. Washington, and its successors right up, I think, to Jackson, were clearly concerned about the overall effect of the society on educating people so that they would become citizens of a new nation. It was small e, can I use that, small e education, as an essential part of what they were worried about, to create a generation that would was capable of creating a nation. Mr. Washington left something in his will about it. Others spoke to it pretty much all the time. I think that perhaps the word creation of a nation through the education of its citizens by all sorts of means, the press and others, may be the point. Let me try some quotes out on you here. There'll be snippets. This is where I think you ought to watch me, obviously. Let me read John Washington on the subject of, this is a message he sent about setting up a university. Among the motives for such an institution, the assimilation of the principles, opinions, and manners of our countrymen by the common education of a portion of our youth from every quarter well deserve attention. From every quarter well deserve attention. The more homogeneous our citizens can be made in these particulars, the greater will be our prospect of a permanent union. And a primary object of such a national institution should be the education of our youth in the science of government. Try John Adams. Listen to the reason he gives to support Washington's idea. Set it up. As the only means of preserving our Constitution from its natural enemies, the spirit of sophistry, the spirit of party, the spirit of intrigue. My God, all those Adamses say the same, don't they? the spirit of party, the spirit of intrigue, the profligacy of corruption, and the pestilence of foreign influence. That's what you got to set this thing up for. He's a determined fellow, John Adams. Now, that passage, I mentioned something about Mr. Jefferson when it came to what he might do if he had an amendment that would permit him to do it. This was when he actually had, I'd forgotten this, he actually had a surplus in the budget at one point in his presidency. Obviously, it didn't last long. But what he said was, their patriotism, people as a whole, I'm going back to this conception of education, of the people for creating a nation. Their patriotism would certainly prefer its continuance and application to the great purposes of, and listen to the mixture of what's involved, of the public education, roads, rivers, canals. Those are all in the same sentence. It gives you, again, is it not this conception of binding, methods of binding, of creating? That's Mr. Jefferson. And one of my favorite quotes, because this idea obviously continued long past the founding presidents, the early president. My favorite quote is probably unexpectedly some years later, because this theme continues occasionally, though less so, from President Grant, who took this view of the continuing education and the nature of the forces that did it, in this sentence: next to the public school, the post office is the great agent of education over our vast territory. You can make a pretty good case for that, you know. Now, that era ended, obviously. We all know some of the reasons that it ended. The general note that I've struck here about education with a small e sort of petered out a little bit. There was an echo in Grant at the time before the Civil War and afterwards. The Civil War itself, I suppose, you could say that there, in this little book, there is no quotation from Abraham Lincoln. And I asked myself, did there need to be? Because obviously the major purpose was keep the nation together. In that sense, it was a massive education, but a ghastly one. In any case, there are no quotes from Lincoln. And in the period after the Civil War and up through to about Theodore Roosevelt, the particular issues taken up by presidents were of a different sort. nation, the message seemed to be dealing with changing from building the several pieces into the nation, of the nation into some kind of interconnected whole, to absorbing what was seen as new things coming in. I'm making a rough category here, a second category. They're roughly speaking, from the Civil War through theater, into Theodore Roosevelt, were dealing with Puerto Ricans, or immigrants of all sorts. How do you deal with that? Puerto Rican, Hawaiian, Alaskan. And of course, the education of the blacks was education came in that context. Education was seen, and here the schools were particularly mentioned, were seen as the instruments for trying to solve some other kind of social problem. And I have a bunch of quotes here, which is, by the way, echoed later by in Harding and Coolidge, the same post World War I, would have the same echoes. You may say at this point, well, come on, during the period just before the Civil War, the beginning of the land-grant universities was a decisive act by presidents to do something about universities. Well, I'll be damned if I can find the presidents in there. Buchanan vetoed it to begin with. I think he vetoed the Morrill Act. It was signed later. It was in connection with a long-standing policy of the use of public lands for various purposes. The only shift was that the public lands were used for setting up educational purposes with an agricultural and mechanical arts ratio. But it wasn't that radical a change in the sense of presidential leadership for education as a part of a program, other than a program that would help solve some other problem. You can see the point I'm making here. Theodore Roosevelt, who it won't surprise you, was quoted at some length, because Mr. Roosevelt apparently had the habit of covering almost everything in his messages, and he got to this one, he was not really on the creation of the nation. He was not so much actually on some of the individual issues in migration, race, absorption of other peoples. He was really more on the relation of education to economic development, to international rivalry. Let me just quote him. This one sort of interested me. Wouldn't be very fashionable today, but it was a sort of a bully pulpit, and he was taking off on it. Our industrial development depends largely upon technical education, including in this term all industrial education, from that which fits a man to be a good mechanic, good carpenter, or blacksmith, to that which fits a man to do the greatest engineering feat. The skilled mechanic, the workman, can best become such by technical industrial, and you can imagine how it goes on from there. He actually was very dubious about liberal education. Came down rather hard, saying we're not doing it right. In international rivalry, this country does not have much to fear the competition of pauper labor, as much as it has to fear the educated labor of specialized training competitors. In international rivalry, that's the first sign of that note with Theodore Roosevelt. Now, obviously, you've been hearing it since, both federally and by in the states. And Woodrow Wilson took that line too, by the way. That's about his only message on educational matters, despite his long career at Princeton. The one that they quote here, a bill was passed in the Senate which provides for the promotion of vocational and industrial education, which is of vital importance to the whole country, because it concerns a matter too long neglected, upon which the thorough industrial preparation of the country for critical years of development immediately ahead. Then the House must pass it. That's, by the way, the quote on education from Woodrow Wilson. I go back. It's interesting how what the topics were and how relatively little there was and what the topics were. And you will find that echo, of course, in President Eisenhower. Now, that's the second theme. The third theme was then the use of education for economic and other development, including finally the international one. What I'm in fact suggesting at this point is that the president seemed, and here's the amateur historian, seemed to be particularly concerned with education, with a small e, the whole educative process, on creating a nation of people who understood voters, breaking down rivalries, breaking down factions. The second, the adaptation of the nation to new citizens, Puerto Rican, if you wanted to call the blacks new citizens. Third, the defending of the nation against external competition. Now then I think with Mr. Franklin Roosevelt, which is where I came in, you know, as somebody at that state to be able to notice what was going on. With Franklin Roosevelt, education then got into another category which hadn't been so explicitly stated before. That is, education, schools particularly, schooling level, became a right by itself. That's a sort of a fourth theme. Where is that quote? He put it in, you remember, in some of his international things, but there's a specific statement of Mr. Roosevelt. Yeah, this was in 1944, towards the end of his life. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. Among these rights are the right to a good education. Then gets it. Isn't that a different category? You're not using it as an argument for a particular social purpose. It's getting into a different category. And then he proceeded, of course, to at least talk about it, but never really make any proposals related specifically to schools or universities, not in the sense that took place in the Kennedy Johnson era. There is, however, two points that I think might be made about the Roosevelt time that affect the universities. First, and here I'm using James Finney Baxter's book about scientists at war. Some of you will remember that was the history of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, which was the office developed during the Second War for doing research on everything, radar, rubber, and the atomic bomb. And as I read Mr. Baxter's history, President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, made a decision, perhaps casually, I don't know. That committee, which was formed to govern research during World War II, consisted of university people, James B. Conant of Harvard, the dean of engineering at MIT, Baxter himself was an historian. It was formed for another purpose. And when it came to massive support of research connected with the war, that OSRD, Office of Scientific Research and Development, used the universities heavily, used the university professors lots to do a lot of the research, not the military ordnance. The old government military ordnance units. They use the universities and the application of the universities. Is it fair, Ken, to say that prior to World War II, government research really played a very minor role in universities in America? And that beginning in 1942, how about medicine, Tom?
Oh, absolutely. Clear line.
But the point was, I don't know how conscious that decision was. I'm not even sure that it was a conscious decision of the Congress. You can read it in Baxter's book. You can see it developing with Conant and who am I talking about at MIT? The dean at MIT. Van Bush. Those were the key fellows. I say this because the impact on universities by that decision or non-decision or whatever happened was enormous. And it was a presidential decision, if only made by letting it happen or encouraging it to happen. I have to emphasize it's a massive change on what, 50 to 100 universities in America. Is that about right? Mm-hmm. Something like that. The second decision, also related to universities made by Mr. Roosevelt, was to preside over something that I don't think he expected to have a major effect. The GI Bill, I served on that committee that Ken mentioned, proposed to Mr. Roosevelt that when the war was over, the national task was to fill the vacancies of educated people made vacant by the war. Young men were not going to college. They were not going to medical school. Well, they were, I guess, in medical school, but they weren't doing engineering. They weren't doing PhDs. They weren't doing this and that. And the proposal that was put up to Mr. Roosevelt that he sent forward, but he began to change his mind, I think, simply said, first year, let all the GIs have a whack at it, and then from that point on, compete. Make an estimate of what you need, and, you know, it's every man's duty is to serve his country. What's all this, you know, that's their job. Obviously, you take care of the wounded, but otherwise, you just fill up the gaps. Didn't last a minute. And the reason it didn't last a minute, the GI Bill provided funds based not on that at all, but based on length of service in the military. That was the basic system by which the money was handed out, was because the president and his advisors were very worried about mass veteran unemployment at the end of World War II. The principal motivation was fear of unemployment. And this was one way to get them off the streets. And everything considered, deans aren't bad. Put them in charge of deans. They're sort of like sergeants. You know what I mean? In any case, the more strong political motivation, no question about it, was at a time of fear of unemployment. Now, the net effect of that on higher education was huge. But as to whether the original intent was unemployment, I don't want to say. It's obvious that once again, then, the educational institutions in World War II were being used for other purposes. For other purposes, and if some quotes from the Miller Center are halfway true, they still are. Let me quote first on this topic of science and the universities. Dave Robinson was here. If you'll permit me to say so, he's an official of the Carnegie Corporation, not Rockefeller, so it's open, wide open view here. Dave Robinson said, by the end of the Second War, the relationship between science and the government was a close one, one of mutual confidence. I'm not sure that's true anymore. Robinson's historical statement is correct. Or the statement that Bill Carey, who came here too, and it's he's making the same point about science that I'm making about education in the presidential eye. Let me read Bill. He used to be in the Bureau of the Budget, and he's now with the AAAS. Science rarely travels into the Oval Office under its own flag. Most of the time, science gets there because it is embodied in some other very large policy question. I'm quoting on science, a statement. By the way, Bill went on to lament, you know, Bill's getting to be my age. He lamented, the president doesn't spend much time reflecting on the beauties of science. I think that's undoubtedly true. Now, you've noticed I batted up these four themes for presidential messages and I draw out of these. Now, I want to point out that they don't rise, fall, and disappear, as far as I can make out. They rise, fall, and sometimes come back again. Sometimes come back again. Let me look over the four of them. The question of creating a nation, the conscious thought of using various instrumentalities to create a nation. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that wasn't very much on the minds of Nixon, certainly of Ford, probably of others. You take the question of absorption of new citizens with different cultural or linguistic or other backgrounds. Bilingual education. We have the delightful situation in which a strong case is being made that everybody should be taught English and to hell with other languages by that well-known Yankee Senator Hayakawa. There's a strong movement going on all over the country for that. That theme comes in and out, and will come in and out again, I suspect. Take the theme of using education, as quoted from, I happen to use Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, as part of economic development. Listen to any message from governors to their states. The governors, by the way, have been leading in educational change for the last 15 years. This is not Nixon, not Reagan's. It goes back to Carter's time. The governors have been taking the lead. And just look at their messages sometime about the use of education for economic development by the state, often in the context of international competition. Has that been true in this state? Or take that the international issue itself. You can go back practically to Washington, certainly to the 1810s period. World War I, World War II, and clearly we might have it again. We may have other presidential messages on the importance of how to deal with the enemy. I found it myself rather entertaining to become Commissioner of Education to administer something called the National Defense Education Act, I think that's what it's called, which was passed through the Congress rather rapidly by that well-known political leader, Khrushchev, who sent up the Sputnik, you remember. That was the most effective educational performance I ever saw in the Congress. And how old were we going to beat him? I couldn't help. I was supposed to administer this thing. We were supposed to beat him right away, because one got the sense that the world was coming to an end, by improving the teaching of middle school science and by teaching children foreign languages, including, of all unlikely things, Spanish. That I really do have trouble sometimes with how this legislation comes through. But we may have that again. Doesn't it seem possible to you? I just hope you keep your sense of humor about it. And finally, what do you think is going to be the effect of the new Immigration Act? Is education going to be used for that, differentially perhaps in different parts of the country? Well, frankly, I think it's possible. I think we think it's possible. Now, I want to remind you that all of this discussion and presidents, right back to the beginning, took place with the three constant themes that affected all the presidents in somewhat different ways at different times. Two of them, well, I guess all three of them, really, are constitutional. First, all the things I've talked about, the relation of religion to the state and to education. All of them that way. When I got to Washington, one of the first things I did was to report up to the White House, where Mr. Kennedy, by the way, remembering that I was a classmate of his older brother Joe at Harvard College, established our personal relationship immediately. He said, "Didn't you run against Joe for class marshal in 1938? "Yes, Mr. President." "Didn't he beat you 3-2? "Yes, Mr. President." And then everything, from that point on, everything went swimmingly, you said. But it was that same meeting where I was turned over to Sorensen. And Sorensen said, "Now look, Frank, you got to remember, the president's Catholic. And the one thing he can't appear to be is Catholic. So I'm going to send you over to see the local Washington bishop. And from that point on, keep us out of it." Right. Was sent to the senior bishop of the Catholics that dealt with educational matters and never checked in with the White House again. You see why? Church, state, and schools. That theme right through. Number two, race. From the very beginning to today, right through. I think those are two constitutional issues. The First Amendment, if you want to make it the 14th, you can. And finally, federal-state relations in a federalist system of government. Mr. Jefferson wanted amendments. Finally, we didn't, never did get an amendment, but this, a lot of legislation passed. The lawyers sort of ran out of breath or something. But those three issues have been consistent all the way through, and every president has had to deal with them. It's sort of tempting, you know, to sort of guess what some of the what some of the issues might be. Is it possible that that final theme of education for itself that Franklin Roosevelt really started, and that you hear talk about more and more, as a quote right, end quote, do you see that as a continuing theme in presidents to come? Or will, as you look at it, think that the president will always have to use this enormous instrument, and it is an enormous instrument, to solve problems? National, national social, national economic, international. Is that going to have to be the principal way the president, any president, looks at these issues? I'll be damned if I know. I can only say that I think it would be unwise to assume that any of the themes that I've brought to you before will ever completely die. In other words, I think the look on education, both schools by themselves and the larger sense of paideia, is it going to be a continuous phenomenon. Now, I'm going to end on this note. My final question. Here's 200 years, a little more than 200 years of history, focused on the president. A lot of things have happened. The constitutional limitations on the national government dealing with the state issue of the states has been hurdled. Actually, national politics, in the sense of political parties, have now entered the scene where they weren't 15 years ago. I remind you that that Mr. Carter had strong backing from one of the teachers' unions. By the way, do you know how many people are listed in the Bureau of Occupations as school teachers? Not college and university, but, you know, preschool on. 3,600,000. What that means is that about one out of every 30 employed adult Americans is teaching school, or 35, whatever it is. Now, the National Education Association stopped being a professional association some years back, became a union, and then started political activity, and had a very strong influence in the Democratic Convention at the time of the Carter nomination. And I guess as a thank you note, President Carter agreed that he should establish the Department of Education. Mr. Reagan didn't seem to think that that was a thank you note that had any permanence, and he tried to stop the Department of Education. By the way, it doesn't make any difference whether you have one or not. You can get to the White House on a bicycle. The question is, are you asked to get to the White House? You don't have to have a limousine. That doesn't make much difference. The point I'm trying to make is that it's now gotten political, at least in the leadership of the those representing the teachers. Not, I think, the teachers themselves. As far as I can make out, their voting habits are just like the rest of the American people. But the lobby is there. That wasn't true before. That's a 15-year, 20-year phenomenon. Despite the fact that the constitutional limitation in regard to the states has been hurdled, despite the fact that national politics have reached into the schools and colleges, it's remarkable that the federal government still keeps hands off, by and large, curriculum. This, by the way, would not be true of the French government, the Italian government, even the British now, even the British to a degree, I think, keeps hands off curriculum, personnel appointments, and the basic financing, the big financing of either schools or colleges. Leave out the research, which obviously does in science. Every president seems to agree with that. Will they continue to? I don't know. Thank you, sir.
I think we ought to let you raise the first question if you'd like to, and deal with this more broadly than anyone.
Well, this is grateful, brings a lot of memories back to the mid-60s. Frank was in the middle of it. I wonder if we could go on to Mr. Johnson, and I wanted to what extent we did have a major move in support of education from the federal government in the Johnson administration. To what extent was this really an interest of the president, or was it his response to a major move by the whole educational establishment?
I think of the presidents that I would have any personal estimate of, which include Mr. Roosevelt. I went to the same school and went to school with his kids, you know, Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt. Some little idea of the others, varying amounts. I think that Mr. Johnson personally was more interested in schooling and teaching than any other president by a damn sight. He started life as a school teacher to begin with. He taught the Hispanic kids. I think he was genuinely interested. He found that the way to get an education bill through the Congress, that was a complicated issue, church and state, and civil rights involved, that was mixed up in that, was to hitch it to a program that picked out a group of children, in this case children defined as poor in economic terms, by census tract terms, and pour money in there. That you'd get the Congress to go for. And seemed to soften the church-state issue a little. But I don't think that was, he did that solely for that sake. I think he just wanted to do something about those schools. I didn't have that sense of Mr. Kennedy, particularly. I certainly didn't get the sense of it from Mr. Nixon. And I really don't confess, I just don't know the present, but none of the evidence suggests that it's true. But Johnson, certainly, that's personal. I think he was in favor of higher education just as long as it didn't smell too damn much like Harvard. Did you get that sense, yeah, too?
Next question.
Frank, I would like to hear you elaborate on the church part of this. By that, I have a sense that a large part of the public at the moment is concerned about moral education. The church seems to have lost its clout. The universities and the schools are scared to death of it because they get criticized wherever they go, and it ends up falling straight down the middle. What are your thoughts on what's going to happen in this regard?
Again, since I'm playing the amateur historian, I just have to remind you how strongly the people felt about the relation of church and schools, particularly primary schools, even more, much more than universities, the church-relatedness, primary schools and maybe the early secondary school. And that certainly goes back a long way. I have a quote here from General Grant. You wouldn't have thought him he'd worry about that. Oh boy, was he worried. That was, of course, at the time of a lot of Catholic in-migration to the United States. The reason I start that way, Tom, is because this stuff seems to echo in our bones. People get nervous. They get when religion gets a little too close to, you know, do you want to turn McGuffey over to the Pope John? You know. You get nervous about it. It's okay when it's Protestant, you understand. It gets more complicated. Schools, I think it's a problem bad enough in universities, but you know more about that than I will. In the schools, there's a movement which frightens me, to deal with the problems of moral education by way of psychological findings. To begin with, I don't think I trust psychologists that much in general to make public policy, but that's just because I'm an old man, maybe. But we had a long, long history, a very long history in this country and Europe of the problems involved when you are teaching explicit doctrinal-based behavior. And I think the people are unhappy because the kids aren't behaving, which is another way of saying the people aren't behaving. Because clearly there's an echo phenomenon. And I frankly just think we got trouble. And who's going to get blamed? School teachers. And that's normal. But I frankly, Tom, I just think we got trouble. One of the things that we have trouble.
Sure.
And what it does, but it goes in waves, and one of the things that I don't understand is, for example, in some parts of the country, you have what you see in the press as the growth of mostly right-wing Protestant, but some Catholic, schools, doctrinally, fundamentalist schools.
Yes.
And you'd think they were growing all over the country. Well, they grow, but they die. You get a small, the numbers in each school are quite small in any community. They don't last all that long. So at the total percentage of students in non-public schools has gone up barely a percentage point or two. But tremendous amounts of this going up and down. Maybe we ought to thank God for it. Maybe that's one way of solving it, or that made it a big deal. I'm worried, that's all I'm saying. Better not make me commissioner. I don't have Bill views on the matter.
When you talk about this right of education that you say Roosevelt started, don't you think that in a sense that's dangerous when people feel that they have this right to be educated rather than the privilege of education? And maybe in a sense it's better for the federal government not to become too much the vehicle.
We certainly, the federal government actually never started this anyway. All Mr. Roosevelt was doing was kind of putting the end to what the states had largely done about a right up to age something,
mm-hmm.
14 or 15. I may say that it would make an awful lot of difference if you're a school teacher if the kid thought he didn't have a right to be in that classroom. You'd have some different attitudes. I think the real question, the toughest one now, politically, the real question is, post-secondary. Does Mr. Roosevelt's word, a right to a good education, mean a right to post-secondary education? Well, we're edging up to it. The present policies of the government, which is one of the reasons why the federal government, one of the reasons why it is not in your curriculum, is because of a decision made in the 60s and 70s to provide money to the student and let him go where he wants to go, or her go, and not give it to the university. That, after all, is the fundamental political decision made by the federal government. Now, that means if you just provide money without any selection, the money is provided without regard to merit. The money is provided solely on the basis of financial need.
All right.
And it comes close to, it isn't yet stated as a right, but it comes jolly close to it. I'm a little conservative on that one, but never mind.
Victory.
A couple. I think there's been a shifting of opinion, public opinion, in some states at least. More and more in the last 10 years have seen, at least I've seen, where state funds or local funds are used for busing to Catholic schools, they're used for shared facilities like libraries, sporting equipment. Now, could they build on that? Couldn't they break down that sense of division between church and state?
Well, the first, I think, clearest case of that, by the way, forgive me if I wander in with casual remarks, I found myself in a position in 65 where I had to make speeches about busing. It was a civil rights era, you know, and the commissioner had to make speeches. And I had a boss called Tony Celebrezzi, who was the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. And Tony was an awful good boss. He didn't have some goon sitting over your shoulder looking at your speeches, you know. He said, go make the speech, but send me a copy, because somebody might complain. So I'd make the speech and send a copy up to Celebrezzi. Oh, very rarely did he fuss about it, you know. One time he sent for me, and I thought, oh boy, what's happening? And he said, Frank, you're making a lot of speeches you seem to have to about busing. And I said, yes, sir. Seems to be mixed up in the job. He said, now look, in Cleveland, he was mayor of Cleveland, that word causes a lot of trouble. I said, yes, I suspect it does. He said, no, you don't know what I mean. In Cleveland, the older people think that when you're saying busing, you're meaning kissing, and I don't want my commissioner.
Oh,
I never got over that. Isn't that wonderful? The issue took a particular form of using the public school busing system, which, you know, really, I suppose, when did we really start that? In the 20s, I guess, or something like that. It really made the American high school what it was, where you could get a lot of kids in the bus and take them to a bigger high school, big, more labs and things. In New Jersey, the so-called Everson case, E-V-E-R-S-O-N, which was a Supreme Court case, split, what was it? Who's a lawyer here? 5-4? It was a close decision anyway. As to whether the bus could slip by and pick Johnny up and go by the public school and take the kid to the parochial school. In other words, use it for moving kids to parochial schools. Oh, big issue. I can't really remember. I think the Supreme Court came down saying it was all right, but they could have come down the other way because it was 5-4. And everybody's been worried about your point since the Everson case. It's the question of the degree of intrusion. Is there a professor of law here? The degree of
entanglement
by the federal government, or by the executive, by the government, in church-state matters. Now, is that an entanglement, and how deep does it go as an entanglement, if you take the kids? Or the Title I of the Elementary Secondary Education Act of 1965 was the next major issue, which has come up before the federal courts. That, for example, permitted the provision of textbooks to parochial school students who were poor, provided they were the same textbooks that were used by the public schools. That was the rule. That's been taken up, and I think the courts haven't chucked that one down. But then if you hire a bunch of poor kids who are going to parochial schools, and by the way, the parochial schools, in my judgment, are doing a very good job in a lot of the cities. You'd sort of like to help them if you could. I'm an Episcopalian, so I suppose I have no religion, if you know what I mean. If you take the teacher teaching handicapped children, let's say for the sake of argument, the parochial school, and you take the teacher, pay them federal tax dollar, going in there, and there are some crosses on the walls. Entanglement? Well, one court said yes. It's the entanglement problem. Where do you get entangled? Mr. Jefferson's wall between, what's the famous quote, church and state? Yeah. It's kind of serpentine. But he believed in those too. Now that I remember my architecture.
You mentioned presidents and their references to education as a tool of foreign policy. I've seen some marvelous examples of its use, and I regret that it seems as a surprise to the Kissinger Commission that it was something that they might recommend. My question is...
I don't think Henry ever believed in education. He went
all right. Have you ever seen, I don't think I have, a comparison of how much the Soviets do in relation to how much we do?
I don't.
Do the Soviets do more of it than we do? We hear a lot about it. I don't hear a great deal of what we've done lately, but of course, as you know, in the days of the Institute of Inter-American Affairs and Nelson Rockefeller's effort, we did an awful lot of good.
I don't know the figures, I'm ashamed to say. I simply don't know the figures, but I'm sure that they must be very substantial figures. In a way, we've separated off, Edward knows more about this than I do, I have a sense that we've separated off our domestic, the presidents have our domestic educational things from our foreign educational, seem to come in different worlds, kind of. Mm-hmm. Luke Battle tried to make some sense out of that once, but I don't know if it ever worked. He tried. But I think it's notable that, aren't I right, that the Fulbright program was not started by a president.
Yeah, that's right.
Put down Nectar.
I was interested in your comment, sort of question, about what would happen as a result of the new immigration law, mm-hmm. and whether that would cause us to spend money on immigrants who are now legal but who still don't know English. In that connection, it's kind of interesting that the state of California passed a constitutional amendment last week saying that there's only one language in California, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which means that everything now that was in Spanish would get up, even off the ballots, I understand.
You mean the school teachers can't take a kid who speaks only Spanish and teach them with a Spanish textbook or the science?
I'm not sure the implications of it, but I think for all official documents,
yeah, that's
and things
that's
like
that,
it's only one language, and mm-hmm. apparently you can't force a person to speak mm-hmm. Spanish now in a place of business or something like that. It doesn't provide Spanish, the right to speak Spanish, I guess, in state institutions. My question is, might this not go just the other way, though? Is it possible that the immigration law could result in more nationalism in this country? If California is an example, and California has long been a rather liberal state, if that's the mood in California, is it possible that the Immigration Act may have the opposite effect of saying we don't want to spend money to accommodate people who don't know the English language well and a lot of other things?
Well, I think there's certainly that's happening to a degree already. I don't question that. It may have a differential effect, of course. Take circumstances where the proportion, and this would be primarily Hispanic, I assume, at the moment we're talking about, though I don't know, but what I see that in the District of Columbia, the blacks are getting mad at the Koreans?
Chinese.
Have it, Koreans? It may scatter and it's splay. I just don't know. I think unquestionably, part of the reaction to the immigration bill in some parts of the country will be a revival of the 1920s Americanization.
Right, that's what I'm getting at. Up in Northern Virginia, for example, we've got lots of Vietnamese refugees, I understand, in the public schools, and some special efforts have been made for them. I just wonder whether this mood may result in people saying, if our grandparents could do it, these kids ought to do it.
Well, they are. They're saying that. And in fact, a good deal of the great Jewish intellectual tradition of New York City is saying that right now. That's unquestionably part of it. I can't even begin to guess is how the differential effect it'll have. The town I happen to live in Cambridge, in Massachusetts, now has 23 different languages spoken in the homes. And some of it is English. Call it Boston English, but the point is that's a very mixed up deal. I just don't know how it's going to come out. I see all sorts of signs of a kind of an Americanism, 100% variety, turning up. But these are big numbers we're talking about, and they're scattered in different parts of the country that we haven't thought about before much. The percentage of, I think I'm right, the percentage of Hispanic speaking in Denver is something like 20%.
That's right.
Is that about right?
Mm-hmm.
And the figures in Detroit's quite high. But of course, then you have different Hispanic streams from Puerto Rican as compared to Caribbean, to Mexican, and so forth. I can't make sense out of it. The fact that the argument is politically turning on whether you use a pedagogical technique called bilingual, some form or another, you teach the home language first and translate it into the English. The fact that that's turning into a political issue, which it is, is sort of troubling, because what you're doing is ducking the real issue and fighting about a technique. But that's happened before in American history of education. Probably will again.
Howard Cromwell. What is your assessment of the recent court rulings favoring fundamentalists' right to restrict the use of textbooks? Will it be, in your opinion, maybe squelched by higher courts? And if it isn't, can you foresee some real complications here?
My word, people know a lot around here. I know one opinion, but there's a second one that I don't know. Oh, a district court opinion. The one that I do know is the one that said, okay, if the parents object to the use of this textbook, which is probably what, some kind of science or something, tell the kids they don't have to read it, or take them off into another room or something. Isn't that about... No. There's another opinion. There's another case somewhere around...
That was a Tennessee opinion, and one coming up in Alabama.
That's the one. It's the Alabama, which I don't understand. Every once in a while, I wonder if you share my view, you sort of wish the courts would stay the hell out of something. The trouble is, that isn't the way we got the court system. If somebody gets the case into the courts, then they got to do something. The judge has got to do something. You know, that's the rule of the game. It gets up to him, he's got to do something. He can't just sit around and throw it out. I think the common sense, frankly, of the educators, I think we'll sort of bury that one. You know, most of the kids will sort of sneak back in and take a look. It depends on how active the parents are. We've had this kind of up and down before. I sort of hope it disappears, frankly. It doesn't get up to the Supreme Court. How the devil do they decide that in a sensible way? I just hope it doesn't get there. Now, hope is no answer to your question. In the particular case that you mentioned, what I sort of hope is that there's some sensible people in that particular school system will say, all right, we'll do this for a while, and let's just see what happens on next September. And then there are three kids left, and next September they sort of forgotten about it. I hope that's what happens. Because we have a clear conflict between two very desirable goals. One of them, we do want parental responsibility for the children. If you take everything away from them, well, come on, we do want it. We depend on it for the kids' learning. So I want to go a fair distance down the way the judge would. But I bet you if we had the judge in here and we closed all the doors, he'd say, geez, I hope they forget about it.
One final question, Matt Alder.
Do you think that the problem of functional illiteracy is becoming sufficiently severe throughout the country that it will eventually become, for economic as well as educational reasons, a source of concern for a presidential message?
Yes, if so, it'll be the second time. It was a very vigorous concern. I left out some of my quotes in the period from 1865 to 1900, in which a number of the presidents were very concerned about illiteracy. Incidentally, that famous literate president really had quite a piece in here on that subject, Warren Harding. The answer is yes. I think it is coming back. Now, whether this has to do with the fact that that part of what I described as the American paideia, the education, whether people are actually, because of films and television and things, actually reading less. I mean, one thing for sure is if you don't read, you forget. You sure as hell forget, and if they're reading less, we have an awful problem. But if you ask my opinion, I certainly do think it's coming up. And I wouldn't be in the least surprised if the current president or the next one didn't have it in a message. But why it's going on, I don't quite know.
We've been talking quite a bit about adding a wing to this building, and most of the discussion has had to do with what you do with the foundation and the basement, and there's an awful lot of debate about that. Some people that have, like Wilson Newman, who built buildings, are very anxious that we get that right, get it straight. Similarly, in this series, it's fortunate that Frank Keppel didn't adopt the view of a recent visitor to the Miller Center. He said, as he began his talk, I hope you didn't think I was going to follow your outline or your topic, and he didn't. But because Frank Keppel did, why I think, I suppose President Shannon might agree, I think we're off to a fairly good start. that isn't at all surprising. One of the memories I have, you may live this way yourself, are these little fleeting memories. One of the best things about working in New York was that there were two or three university presidents who used to visit the foundation. I wasn't always absolutely sure about what they were asking specifically for, which was a relief. I always, especially if they had the time, I always felt that the whole area of education had been greatly illuminated, and I would put Edgar Shannon at the top of the list. I remember a whole afternoon with him alone one time when he talked about his philosophy of education. Exactly that same thing was true of Frank Keppel when he talked to us. He was there a little more frequently, although he was sometimes on the road as the president of University of Virginia. We tried to get a couple of the formal leaders of education, and it may not surprise you in thinking of this nationalizing function of education. The president of this university is in Arizona. The dean of the education school is in Oklahoma. So maybe on another date we could talk about this nationalizing function of the educational leadership of the nation, because it accomplishes some of the things that Washington was talking about. And Frank Keppel, unfortunately for those of us in New York, would sometimes be called on that way. But when he was around, he always threw a sharp light, a bright light, in those corners that we didn't understand much, and he's done exactly that same thing today. And so if we follow up from here on in talking about presidents in education, it isn't his fault. Thank you very much.
Thank you.